So fun! We're off to jolly old England for our July cultivated audio. Speaking first is Rosie Ball at Falscombe, a historic 300-acre rare breeds farm in Devon. Callum Edge from Edge and Son Butchers is carrying on the artistry his ancestors started when they opened up shop in 1844. Definitely one of the first regen ag businesses. Their craftsmanship is based on respect to bring, as Callum says, the best from farm to fork. Sally Lee rounds out July literally talking turkey A to Z. Her rural turkeys are the gold standard of humanely raised and produced. I'm Robin Clare. Ready to dig in? Rosie, I believe you may own the bragging rights to working on the oldest estate I may find. 1537 was a few years back.
It certainly is one of the old ones, but the UK is quite scattered with lots of ancient manor houses and wandering grounds attached to them, some of which has been sort of divided up and isn't sort of representative of the historical landscape, and others have been very well preserved.
Yes, and are there any records detailing animal management from the days of yore?
No records as such as that I'm aware of. We do have access to a few historic photographs of the manor house, and some of the structures that have been left indicate how livestock might have been moved around the farm, certain crossings of the stream, and we've got many old stone gateposts and such. So I think there's definitely been livestock on the land for a long time.
Yes. Well, tell us about where you are in England and about the landscape and climatic conditions.
Yeah, so Falscombe Farm is in the southwest of the UK, and so we're between the coastline, and we're about half an hour's drive maybe from the coast, and the moorland. Some people might have heard of Dartmoor. We're nestled in a little valley with some steep but fairly productive pastures. It's about 300 acres of pasture, some herbal lays and some woodland, and our climate is quite wet, I'll be honest, especially last year. So our annual rainfall is 800 to 900 millimeters a year, and average in summer months I'd say around 60 millimeters ish, and in winter months maybe 110. So for our soil, which is quite loamy and slightly acidic, it's usually relatively free draining, but in the winter months we do find, being in the valley, it does get quite waterlogged, and then we can't keep stock out all year round in any large numbers.
Oh, I see. So they're housed, but do they get out somewhere, or are they housed for periods of time?
So they're housed for as short as possible. So we aim for only 4 months housing in the winter, sort of from like beginning of December to maybe the end of March is our optimum. Last winter, we had to bring them in a lot earlier because it was just damaging the soil to keep them out. But yeah, we try to keep them in as little as possible. And if we can keep a small group outside, then we do that. But mainly we have to think of protecting the soil structure and our grazing and pasture for the following year.
Absolutely. So what do you feed them while they're housed?
We are certified organic and pasture fed. So while they're housed, they're on hay or haylage or silage or a mixture of all, sometimes some straw as well, if the silage is a bit too juicy for them. Yeah, and quite often in the autumn and sometimes in the spring, if the grass isn't quite high enough yield for the stock, then we will supplementary feed with hay or haylage just scattered on the ground in the fields. We used to use round bale feeders, but being located in one place, they tend to encourage poaching in a localized area. So we've now changed our practice to either scattering small bales of hay or rolling out large bales so that you don't get the animals congregating all in one area and damaging the ground.
Yeah, so I don't like the sound of the poaching going on.
Yeah, with our soil and our weather, winter management is hard, which is why we choose to house for the welfare of the cattle. They will choose a lovely dry barn over being outside under a tree any day in a Devon winter. But unfortunately, the ground just can't take it. it would be nice if maybe they had an area where they could wander freely between the field and the barn, but that very area would get irreversibly damaged if we allowed that. So when they're in until the ground is good enough and dry enough for them to come back out.
Is that because of the actual number of cattle that you have?
No, it is simply a recipe of our soil and our climate. We're actually understocked for our acreage at the moment. So we've got about 90 head of cattle and 250 head of sheep. But like I said, just a recipe of our soil structure and climate, quite productive pastures. But in the winter months, our rain comes thick and fast and it just can't drain quick enough.
Yes. Now, previously, Falskholm was an organic property. Tell us about the steps you've been taking to create a more regenerative system on the land. Was there an obvious first step?
For us, yeah, we wanted to become more aligned with a regenerative approach. So being organic is a great first step. And the land had been managed organically for over 20 years, I think, prior to us arriving like 18 months ago. But the first step we made was to become Pasture for Life certified. So we actually chose to stop planting arable crops. We used to grow oats and barley, not a huge quantity, 25 acres or so. And we converted that ground into herbal lays, progressing towards a more minimum tillage structure and hopefully improving the soil structure through selecting specific herbal lay mixes. And we're still learning and seeing the success. We've learned some lessons pretty immediately with the very dry spring. We now will probably try and do autumn reseeds in the future because the drought meant that our germination rate was very low and that the weed competition was very high. So already learning quickly. but we hope that you do something once, you learn, you change it the next time you do it. So we hope to, in the future, have a high percentage of herbal lays on the farm for both grazing and cutting for winter forage. And through those herbal lays, we should be able to fix more nitrogen and, in not ploughing the land, sequester more carbon. That's our first steps at this stage.
Right. Now, you're saying herbal lays. What do you mean by that? I'm sorry, I'm uneducated.
So a herbal lay is a mix of grasses and herbs with different properties. So some have very deep roots, some have more shallow roots, will have some clovers and maybe some plantain species in it. You can choose what you want, but these herbal mixes we would usually only put in for 3 years, and then it gives the land a rest, and then we would normally plant a crop, oats or barley or wheat, for a couple of years, and the ground would get cultivated, and then we would rest it again with the herbal lay. So lay in England is just a rest for the ground in its cultivation cycle, but instead of us growing the crops now, we're looking to just have herbal mixes in the ground constantly and use them for cutting and for grazing. And through the diverse mix of seeds that we're putting in the ground, we're giving hopefully the best chance possible to the soil and all of the microbes for good productive pastures.
Absolutely. And the grazing certainly helps all of that. Now, you beat me to the punch here. I was going to ask you of any obvious mistakes that we might learn from, and you mentioned that. What about an innovation that you've put in place that might seem simple but really worked as a great step?
I don't think in all honesty that we've invented anything new, but we've definitely been trying practices that we've seen others try on our land and see how our land and our animals respond to those practices. So alongside the herbal mixes, we've been trying some rye and vetch as an early forage for the cattle. Because we're organic, our spring growth in the grass is a bit slower than non-organic farms. So the rye and vetch is a bit quicker growing earlier on in the season. And we found that it was really a great mix for our finishing cattle and stopped them plateauing in their weight gain when we first turned them out of the barns and onto pasture. They went onto this rye and vetch mix and we strip grazed it, and it seemed to work really well in just reducing that plateau so that our weight gains were more consistent. And in addition, we're altering some of our grazing practices into more rotational grazing, using lots of electric fencing and figuring out how to get water to awkward corners of the farm.
English Longhorn cattle are your cattle of choice over there. And can you share some of the characteristics that make them a really good cattle for not only England, but also perhaps for beef?
So we chose the English Longhorn cattle partly as they're a heritage breed, and we wanted to be involved in preserving a rare native breed of the UK, and also because they do really well just on grass. They don't need any corn or grain to have good growth rates. They are quite happy munching the hedgerows and just permanent pasture, and we get good growth rates from that. They also have quite a good conversion rate of sort of grass to butterfat yield. So you get quite a good growth rate in the early stages of their calves. And for beef, on a pasture fed system with this type of animal, we take it to at least about 30 months before it's slaughtered. So we get a really full flavor, and being on a pasture fed system, it's really high in omega-3, and the fat is like a really good yellow fat. It's a slow grown animal, and it's not been forced with grain. So those were the main reasons: the quality of the meat and the suitability for a pasture based system alone.
Now, you also have sheep, and are they a great complement to cattle as far as the grazing ease goes? How do they fit in with each other?
So the benefits for us being organic in having sheep and cattle on the land is by rotating their grazing, we can reduce the worm burden, as the worms that are in cattle and the worms that are in sheep will compete against each other. So if we alternate where they are grazing, then we don't need to use any chemical wormers, or if we do, it's very rare.
I don't believe we mentioned your sheep by name, and they're the Manx Lofton breed. And I'm wondering, do they have unique characteristics to their wool?
They're a primitive breed. Their wool is brown, which I guess is quite unusual in sheep. When people picture a sheep, it's usually a white fluffy cloud. but yeah, they're a primitive breed sheep. Their fleece is not so widely used now. They sometimes like self-shed their fleece, which can be handy in the hot time of year when you normally have to shear. We actually usually shear anyway as standard. Just the fly risk is really high. So for the animal's welfare, we shear them. Their fleece can be quite variable. It can have quite a long staple, sometimes in quite short. At the moment, we haven't sourced anywhere that has much demand for it. There's a few small companies for the volume that we produce, and often for the older sheep, their fleeces are not so sought after because the fleece after 2 or 3 years old is of a lesser quality for weaving purposes. So yeah, I'd say that the Manx Lofton we actually selected for the meat qualities and conservation of a rare breed. It's native to the Isle of Man, actually. So not a UK mainland native, but close enough.
Yes.
And they're quite easy care, so they look after themselves a lot of the time.
And then you do have some pigs in the mix. Do they enrich different parts of the property than cattle might, or was somebody just craving some bacon?
Well, the pigs are a bit special. They're probably our most interactive species on the farm. We got the pigs mainly to try and utilize and more sustainably manage the woodland areas. So we've got about 60 acres of woodland. It's a mix of some very old woodland with quarries, and it's quite inaccessible, and some younger planted woodland. And then we were getting quite a few dominant species that were hindering the growth of the younger trees. So we had a lot of ivy and brambles that just tend to dominate and restrict their growth. So we brought the pigs in to help clear the undergrowth a bit and manage the woodland instead of us going in and burning petrol on strimmers to reduce the bramble. We put the pigs in there for a month, 6 weeks, and then we move them onto another patch. And yeah, so it's dual purpose. We get the management of the woodland and some bacon at the end.
It must be so gratifying to see something like that actually happen, right? Really learning how to use the land and perfection of how nature works, where you put the pigs in. And as you said, you don't have to use the petrol and the machinery and go in there with man hours.
Yeah, I mean, we are very much in the learning stages, and it's quite a reactive process. You know, we're constantly watching the animals and the land and trying to find the balance. and all of that in combination with the weather. For example, in the really dry spell that we had this spring, the woodland space that the pigs were in, it lasted for a lot longer than expected because the ground simply wasn't soft enough for them to be able to root in. And then since it rained, we've been having to move them more regularly because they started to dig down to the tree roots. So we had to move them before they started to actually damage the trees. So it's very much a dynamic system, looking at the land, looking at the plants growing on the land and the animals. And, you know, we're trying to be a productive business here. So we need to be conscious of their weight gain and try and make sure that that's sustained throughout their life.
Yes. Now, how is the market in England for grass-fed beef? Do you ever have a hard time selling it?
The market is becoming a lot more popular. I think consumers are becoming a lot more aware of where their food comes from and how it is raised and the impacts of that. And that's on multiple levels. So it depends what people align their ethics most closely to. Some people, it's the animal welfare aspect, in which case, you know, organic standards promote very high animal welfare, no GM content in their food, no artificial fertilizers or pesticides or herbicides, which obviously has a positive impact for wildlife. So anyone with environmental concerns, buying organic is really important for them. The pasture fed side of things, similarly, it really aligns with environmental as well as ethical benefits to the farmland and the animals. And buying locally as well. So for us with the beef and the sheep, we try and market to several different niches. As I just mentioned, organic, pasture fed, rare breed and locally. We don't always manage to tick all of those boxes, and different things are important to different consumers. You know, in a restaurant, for example, the fact that it's locally sourced is often more important to the client than whether or not it's organic. But pasture fed being a lot more popular now is also becoming important to restaurant consumers. I think that there's definitely growing concern about the sustainability of certain agricultural practices. And so a lot more people are thinking and making choices about how and where they purchase their meat products.
Yes, I'm so happy the word is getting out. It just makes no sense to put poison into our land or our animals or our bodies.
Absolutely.
How did you get your start, Rosie, in this type of work?
I grew up rurally, and my parents were sort of more into horticulture, but my grandparents were in farming, and I did a degree in conservation biology and happened to progress from there into doing more practical land management, then after that into farming, which just seemed all a very natural journey to me. I love working outside and I love working with animals. For me, it's just the best mix,
yes.
Being in farming.
Yeah. Rosie, what's your favorite part of a day involved with Falscombe and regenerative agriculture?
For me, the favorite part of my day would be going to check the animals and just simply observing what they have chosen to eat out of the current field that they are in. It sounds a little obscure, but when they've been put in a fresh paddock and you go in after a day and you see what they have and haven't chosen to eat, it's really, really fascinating for me.
I'm sure it is. Now, I also love to see that you're putting out an invitation to support new farm-related artisan businesses. What are you envisioning over there?
Well, it's totally open to ideas. We have recently broached a relationship with a local beekeeper who has put beehives on our farm. And that, I guess, would be one of the first steps that we've made in that direction. We're looking for other local businesses that maybe, like this beekeeper, need some extra land, facilities perhaps that we might be able to support and combine forces to produce edible products, mostly, essentially, whether that be meat or honey or vegetables, that align with our ethics and values of looking after the land and improving it, hopefully, over a long-term time frame.
Yes. Now, Rosie, do you have a favorite steak?
I actually really just like plain sirloin steak. It sounds quite simple. That, for me, is the best way to taste an animal.
All right.
It is so diverse. And
right.
An animal that has grown slowly and has had a good life, the mince will be so flavorsome.
Absolutely. Rosie, is there anything that you would like to share about Regen Ag or what goes on at Falscombe?
Yeah, I guess really our first steps are to go pasture fed to promote a better grazing rotation so that the land has longer rest periods, to establish more complex herbal lays, experiment with a few different forage mixes to see what suits the land and benefits the land as well as our animals, and to reduce tillage in order to sustain soil structure. Those are our key steps towards a more regenerative agricultural system here. And I think it's a learning process for everyone. And you've got to constantly, like I said, be dynamic and change and adapt with the weather changes as well as everything else all around you. So I look forward to hearing other people's experiences as well. We're trying to make a difference and change our ways.
Yes. My mom is English, and so I'm familiar with England somewhat. And there's nothing more beautiful than the English countryside.
It is quite unique, and especially in South Devon where we are, the views are pretty stunning. I sometimes forget how lucky we are, and especially with recent events, to have access to such beautiful countryside and live and work on it on a daily basis. It's a privilege.
Callum, I can't help thinking I've come to the right person to speak about butchering, considering your shop, Edge & Son, first opened in 1844.
Yeah, we're 176 years here, which is five generations. I'm the fifth generation here. But we actually were involved in both agriculture and butchery for two generations before that in a village of Edge, which is by Tilston in Cheshire, which is northwest England. So, yeah, we go back to the mid-1700s. We can trace back the family to then.
Yes, that's amazing. Do you have a favorite story within your family history, being the butcher craftsmen or artisans for so many generations?
Yeah, it's funny actually, because now we've become almost more artisan in many respects. We very unusually have our own slaughterhouse still. And we also only buy grass-fed meat. We only buy native breed meat. There is a little bit of a move this way into sort of regenerative farming nowadays. Yet we really have always stood for that. And we also have always bought from the farms that sort of surround us. So we don't buy any livestock that is 25 miles away from us. So we have a circle that we draw around the business, and all the farms come within that 25 miles. And this obviously minimizes the transportation of the livestock. But it also means that I personally can manage the farms quite easily because there's not too much distance away. And so I can monitor where the livestock is and also what practices all the farms are using and try to talk them round to the ethos that we're behind at the moment.
Oh, lovely. And it sounds like you've been having good success with that.
Yeah, on a success basis, we've obviously, in 176 years, gone through two world wars and now a pandemic. But our success, yeah, we were really quite surprised. In 2009, the RSPCA, which is the Royal Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, awarded us an industry award for the system that we had within our abattoir. And then we sort of realized that we were put forward to one of what we would call the Oscars of the food world, is the BBC Food and Farming Awards. And in 2014, our customers put us forward for that. And we were put onto the shortlist, which we were very surprised at. And we expected to win the Butcher of the Year for the UK. That wouldn't have surprised me. But we not only won that, we won Retailer for the whole of the UK in that year as well. And I think when you win an award like that, it puts you on a little bit of a roller coaster. And the other award that's very noticeable is the Farm Shop and Deli Awards, which is a big show which happens in Birmingham at the NEC, which is right in the middle of the UK. In 2018, we were the overall winner, the same again, Best Butcher, Best Northwest Shop, and then Best Shop in the whole of the UK. You can only ever win them once. So you know, we've been very, very lucky. I often wonder how that it's come to us. And I know why it is. It's because of the ethos of how all the animals are being fed and bred, and killing processes, our hanging process, and also this nose-to-tail that we sell nose-to-tail on all the species that we sell here, which is a bit of a rarity now, where you've often got butchers and food retailers that maybe a high-class one that will only sell the steaks and another one that will only sell the so-called poorer cuts, whereas we actually sell nose-to-tail butchery right throughout the business.
Yes. Now, you mentioned there was a bit of a roller coaster being put on the awards. What did you mean by that?
You get a real spike in business when you've won an award as big as that. And I remember being told at the time by the BBC journalist that was running it at the time, said that this lasts for about 5 years. And he was quite right.
Oh, I see.
And I think we were very fortunate in that 4 years later, we won the Farm Shop and Deli Awards. And so I think we're still in like a honeymoon period from those awards.
I would imagine that the honeymoon would continue just by the fact that regenerative agriculture is growing throughout the world, and certainly in England. And by the sound of it, Edge & Sons has been ushering this in, waiting for the rest of the world to really dig what's going on, right?
Yeah, we saw this. I took over the business about 25 years ago from my father. At that time, my father spent his life just coping with a queue that was in it, butchers, that you just had to keep going because we were so popular. And trends within that, probably the last 40 years, have altered, mainly people going to supermarkets. And so the business was quite a different model for me to take over, with a much older generation of customer, probably the average age, maybe 60 years old. And I realized that we weren't going to be able to stay like that. We needed to be different. And if we wanted to be a competitor to the supermarket, we were going to fail. So we specialized more so in what I knew was going to be a better quality meat, something that we could hang for longer, you know, refrigerate and mature better, and look for the more discerning customer. What I didn't really realize was that that customer also was going to be a lot younger. And so what has been very apparent is that the demographics of the age of our customer has changed massively. I would say now our average age could be closer to 30. And this is young people that are very knowledgeable, and they are wanting to eat meat, that they know where it comes from, that their meat has had a good life and that it's been well looked after. And they believe it has more health benefits than the meat that has been mass-produced. And I think that has given us a real boost in business. At the same time, I think this is what gave us the awards, is because we were very much pushing into this direction. And also actually keeping quite a lot of farms going. We buy 100% from a number of farms of what they produce. So if you've got somebody that turns totally to regenerative farming to get a zero carbon footprint on their farm, they've got to have somebody that's willing to pay them more for that stock, because they're not going to have the footfall that they did have when they were intensive. And so we've opened that market for them, really.
Yes, absolutely. And it sounds like since the beginning, number one lesson here is respect, starting with the animals. And we can see how you follow through all the way to your customers. Now, in choosing only to work with the best bred and fed stock, how do you see the breeding and animal welfare contributing to the quality? And what do you actually see?
It's really interesting you say that, Robin. You mentioned the word respect. So that word respect has been my key word for a long while, not only starting obviously with the animal, but also with our customers, respecting what they want, and also with my team here. We've got a really, really tight team of people that are all wanting to work for the same thing. As regards to get the quality of the meat, the animal husbandry makes a massive difference. I've worked in a slaughterhouse all my life. I'm 58. And stress is an amazing part. We don't want animals stressed anyway. But where I'm looking at it for the quality of the meat, and so for the least stress they have before slaughter, the better that meat will hang, and also the better the meat will be. And so it makes a big difference. And that stress definitely starts on the farm as well. You've got to have cattle that are handled well by experts. As we got further to factory farming, there's a lot of pigs, chickens, cattle. All that they're seeing is a machine that feeds them. And so in many respects, they become very wild, even though they could be indoors, but they have a different way. And obviously, different animal feeds create different ways. So as a ruminant, they are designed to eat grass. And so any ruminant, really, that's not being fed on grass is going to be, it's a bit like having indigestion all the time. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have an unhappy animal. So I think it makes a big difference to the quality of the meat by the stress of the animal itself.
Yes, and it's pretty amazing that you actually have your own slaughterhouse. I would imagine that's very unusual. Maybe you could walk us through when you get the animal and then sort of a time and process procedure that you go through.
So we only slaughter one day a week. In that day, the livestock starts to arrive at 6 o'clock in the morning, but we don't actually start slaughtering until about 9. So even the sheep will get time to settle down in their pens, get used to the new environment. Even though they've only had a short journey to us, but that makes a really big difference, especially with cattle, actually. Cattle are very, very susceptible to it. And so the cattle arrive by 8 o'clock and they're not slaughtering until 12, so they have 4 hours. We have a lairage system. Lairage is the pens that we use when the cattle first arrive. Yes. and sheep. And so what we have is we have one big pen that we can then separate into lots. So I'm a great believer in the socializing of the animals. And so we might have cattle come from 3 or 4 different farms. And we very rarely allow animals to come on their own, so they usually come in twos at least. We reckon this really makes a big difference to them. So they're socialized just with water, with no feed as well. It helps cattle calm. As long as they've got water, they don't need feed at that time. The feed will just create a hierarchy within the cattle, whereas they will settle better when they've come off the trailer just with water. And then we then have a system of separating the gates. The gate system is quite interesting in that each gate opens 270 degrees, which means that if an animal is in a square pen and it's got 4 gates to that pen, that animal can go out of that pen in the direction that it wants to go, not in the direction that we're trying to make it go. Ultimately, it comes into an alleyway. We try to do it so that the animal is as calm as possible, but obviously we are moving it into a cattle box. Our stunning box has no head restraint, so the box itself moves. We can make the box longer or wider or thinner, and the animal arrives in it. We don't crush it. We just restrict it into that area, but we don't put like a big clamp around its neck or a belly plate and lift it off the ground, and then the animal is stunned by captive bolt, which I believe is the best system. So that's what we've designed the system around. And actually also safety for my men as well, because with native breed, we have cattle with very big horns at times, and so you need a system that can accommodate the animal no matter what size it is or what headgear it has as well.
Right. I'm very naive about a lot of this subject matter, but I was surprised about the hanging of the beef, and that seems to be a whole art in itself with how long.
It is, yeah. What you've got to do is take the temperature of the animal down slowly. And so two things, it's a good reason why to have the animal not stressed, and another good reason to have the animal without feeding, because the food, because it's a ruminant, will create warmth within the animal. So we're looking for sort of nil by mouth for maybe 12 to 24 hours, and that definitely helps the temperature of the beef cool. And it also helps the animal calm. We take the temperature down slowly, and then we refrigerate almost 12 hours after the slaughter process, even though the slaughter hall itself is at a lower temperature. When we keep the beef for a long time, we're keeping it between 1 and 2 degrees. So we hang up to 6 weeks. Our hanging store, our carcass fridge, is quite a clever fridge in that it also controls the humidity as well as the temperature. And so we're looking for quite a low humidity, which is the opposite to a lot of the big meat retailers. They're looking for a higher humidity to keep the weight of the animal high, the saleable muscle mass high, where we're looking to dry the meat out for the quality. And then we also have a UVC lighting. And so all our fridge motors have got UVC lighting placed within them. And what that does is it cleans the air as it goes over the lighting. So the air in the refrigerator is recirculating. But as it goes over the cooling fan, it is actually cleaned. So any mold spores that have started to create on the carcasses are then cleaned in the air to prevent them going from one carcass to the next. So for a very old worldy butchers, yes, we have a very high-tech both slaughter and refrigeration techniques.
Absolutely. How long have you been using the UV?
UV, probably 10 years. I actually found about the UV in America. I was an usher for a friend of mine in New York when he got married. And I went to a restaurant in the Italian Quarter in New York. Then they had UVC lighting in a restaurant holding the stocks. And the chef, who was a butcher as well, said that this meat was 6 or 8 weeks hung. And I said, rubbish, you can't do that. You know, and I know what I'm talking about because I'm a butcher and have been there for 170 years.
Right.
All these things. And then he showed me what it was. And so when I came back, I said, that must work. So I looked into it. And actually, we created our own system. You can actually buy them now. We have another retail outlet in Liverpool, and then we've bought one to go in that, which is in like a glass cabinet. But at that time, we created our own one in a big store. And since then, a Michelin star restaurant that we use put one in straight after it. So it is a really great system. You can also do it with ozone. I believe some of the technology came from the marijuana growing industry to get rid of the smell of the marijuana. And so it'll do the same thing for that as well. Somebody told me, again, this is not fact, Robin, but somebody said to me, Indians years ago used to dry their meat out, but it was the UVC that would keep them clean. So the same thing happened years ago. Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, that everything comes back around again. And doing hides and skins years ago, apparently, it's the sun rays that would do it. Yes. I mean, I don't know that, but it's just somebody had told me that for one.
Yeah, I would tend to believe that for sure. Mm. What are the legalities like? Obviously, you are set as far as all of that goes, but can farmers butcher their own beef? I know in the U.S. there have been such strict laws. What is it like in the U.K.?
So I believe that Europe has got the strictest laws of all. They call it the Food Standards Agency in the U.K. that are controlling. It used to be the Meat Hygiene Service. The controls are just quite incredible. It's the main reason there isn't many small slaughterhouses left. Sort of 90% of small houses, or more than that, have closed within the last 40 years. Whenever we slaughter, we have to employ a vet who is in attendance. It's a thing I worry about at the moment, actually, because at the moment, I would say about 80% of that costing is paid for by the UK taxpayer. And we actually, as the industry, only pay about 20%. I think all the governments around the world have got huge, huge decisions to make on how to come out of COVID, and also the UK government about coming out of Europe, of whether things are going to change. And if they were to lift the subsidy that the government pay for our inspection, it will put all of us in small businesses out of business because we just couldn't afford to pay for the amount of bureaucracy and inspection that we have at the moment. So something's got to change. And our business is actually one of the model businesses that's being looked at the moment to see how the Food Standards Agency in the modern world fits into the system. We recently installed a complex CTV system. So we are now on CTV 24 hours a day, of which the Food Standards Agency can log in to see our practices and the condition of the property. I've opted for this because I believe it could be one of the ways that we would be left where we will be able to do the meat inspection and animal inspection remotely, like a Zoom meeting or even like a FaceTime where you come to the end of the slaughter and you show a vet who is remotely the carcasses and the livers and the different parts. And I think this can be done this way. And then we can take the costings of the Food Standards Agency down, because it will be crippling if there is no subsidy. It's difficult to know what's going to happen. And the same thing on this regenerative farming that we're doing now. The UK have a four-day farming conference, and then I think it's a 2 or 3 day, what they call the real farming conference. And real farming is to do with more of the regenerative farming and outside farming and the non-intensive side of it. It's really, really interesting at the moment of the facts that come out about methane gas and our problem with carbon in the world. And, you know, I actually think that farming worldwide could very easily be the saviour to this, because it's obviously that our grasses and trees can make a massive difference, grass especially, actually.
Yes. Callum, we've already spoken about the waste that goes on. Could you maybe speak a little bit about using the little-known parts of the animal? And we know already the importance of not being wasteful when there is so much there to be used.
Of course. Well, again, it's a thing I wanted to do, and I said about our young clients that we have now, and these people are all very aware of waste and plastic and papers. And we have a number of customers that come with their own containers, and we fill the containers instead of using any of our packaging. But on waste, we became about 15 years ago, we have zero waste in our business. There is a certain amount of waste that legality we have to move. So things like cattle heads are part of SRM, which is specifying risk material, and they have to be taken away. But we have been able to, with different restaurants and things like even our bones, we make a lot of bone broth now, which is a bit of a health kick for people
yes.
with low immunity or arthritis and these sort of things. And so nearly all our bones go through into that or for stocks to restaurants. We make a big amount of pet mince nowadays, and we use all the bellies and parts of the animal for animal food, which we've been able to create that trade, to the extent that now we haven't got enough ourselves. If we do more of it, we'll have to buy some of these products in. And as regards to the better cuts, it's just something that we will actually say to the customer, no, we can't have that because we haven't got that part. You'll have to have an alternative. So I would rather do that than actually buy in the alternative from not our stock. So that's what we try to do. We hold ourselves to the stock that we have got. So if we run out of chicken and we can't get free-range chicken, we just don't sell chicken.
Right. Are you finding that you are running out more quickly than usual?
No. At the beginning of COVID, there was a massive spike of people trying to buy and stuff. We had it then. We have a farm that we partner with and we do 1,200 turkeys. But once those turkeys are sold, they're sold. You know, we don't do any more. We also are sort of at capacity with space as well, so that could be one of the reasons we do that. But, yeah, we're pretty particular on where we buy anything from. So whether it is Christmas geese or ducks or whatever, we have a number of farms that we won't differ off that farm because we spent the time getting the relationship and to know that we can hand on heart say that this is what we've produced. We just don't want to lose the trust and the momentum that we've created.
Sure. Now, tell us a little bit about the actual butchering process. What are some of the key points that you've learned are important in the process?
For us, because we are nose to tail, because we have the slaughterhouse, and the key points probably is the expertise of the butchers. So we train everybody in-house. The reason being is because a lot of people have come from butcheries from either supermarkets or factories, and they won't do that sort of traditional method that we do. I think you are always learning, and we are always changing, and so we have customers that want different things as people travel or did travel, and so people will come back and say, you know, I was in Argentina and I had a steak that was such and such, and we always say to people that it's impossible for us not to have the steak because we've got the whole animal. So as long as they bring their phone with a picture of it or we keep an iPad behind the counter and we can Google it, we'll be able to tell what it is from the description generally. And then we will be able to get them for that. Maybe not there and then, but we will be able to get it in some time. So I think it's quite exciting, actually, in that how things have changed. We've certainly changed a massive variety of different steaks and are able to advise. We do a butchery service for a lot of farm shops and farmers, so we can sort of advise them, depending on the time of year, how to maximize the carcass to get the most revenue out of that carcass by cutting it in different ways at different times of the year.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, so the four-quarter of meat, which you would use for Christmas, you're using river beef as a real prime roast, will be ribeye steaks, but that same muscle runs up into the chuck, which is called chuck eye, and then the shoulder part, you can get sort of flat iron and onglette and bavette, which were really like a French steak in many respects. All of those steaks I've mentioned at one time weren't sold 40 years ago, and we probably get almost 100% more per kilo than you would do selling it as mince or a stewing steak or whatever. There will be some trim, so I wouldn't say it's 100% more profit, but the price per kilo is twice as much.
Oh, wonderful. Now, Calum, you do quite a bit of teaching by the looks of things, and are you surprised that the interest has grown so much?
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm probably more surprised than any. I don't know when we started masterclasses. It must be about 12 years ago, or maybe a bit more. I was asked, actually, by a very good customer of ours. It couldn't have been a better bloke. He'd been all over the world, actually, doing cookery courses. He's one of the boss guys for BT, which is British Telecom. He came and did a masterclass with us, loved it, then asked me would I do another one. It was a one-to-one at that time. And I said I was thinking of starting these up. And I asked him his advice as an avid cookery course person. And on his flight to somewhere, he wrote me a lovely email and setting out how he thought I should run it. And that is actually the basis of what we do. And then I personally went to different chefs that were running cookery courses and did them myself just to see how they did it the best and learned how to keep interest within a group of six or eight people. And we generally do sort of 4 to 6. But we're not running them at the moment because of COVID, actually, because of the social distancing. We run them every Monday and they're booked out right the way throughout the year. It's been a very good revenue for us.
What do they actually learn how to do? Do you take a whole chicken? Or
we do a couple of different ones, but the main basic one is they arrive. We have a walk around both the lairage, the slaughterhouse, and our hanging fridge, and we talk about the maturity. We talk about the slaughter process and the welfare and our link with the regenerative farming. And we go from chicken to lamb to pork to beef. So they start learning how to joint a chicken and skin and the difference between the free-range chickens, all the way up to they end up cutting a whole side of beef or being part of a team doing that, and boning. So they're sort of starting with the chicken and ending up like a dinosaur, really, which is how they all feel. So very hands-on, and they get lunch within it. Yeah, it is very popular.
I bet, yeah. I love the way this whole regenerative movement is moving into so many different aspects of our society. It just is amazing to me. People are showing such an interest in how things work.
Yeah, I'm very excited also. And we've just had a new farm that's just come on board. We're not buying livestock from them ourselves at the moment, but they have a dairy farm, not very big, but they have gone totally this way. So they've got all the cows outside grass-fed. They're only milking once a day. They sell a lot of raw milk products. We do their butchery for them. They're making a good profit out of this. And this has all happened within, I suppose, 5 years full-on, but sort of 10 years turnaround. You can turn a farm to a zero-carbon footprint. You can really improve the pasture. And they've really improved their land. They've improved their stock. It's not costing them. They haven't got the stress and the strains they had when they were trying to be intensive in a small way, which doesn't really work anyway.
Right.
I think it's a win for everybody, personally. And actually, we're very lucky in Great Britain and England especially, with such great grasslands and pasture land.
Oh,
and
yes.
There's no really excuse. We've probably got the second best grasslands to New Zealand in the world. So for the UK, it's really, really fast to turn it round from something that is probably creating carbon to something that can actually be absorbing it.
Yes, that's an excellent point, isn't it, about your grasses. Mm. Now, do you have any trade secrets that you hold on to and you don't share?
We do with sausages and some of our recipes.
All right.
We do a sausage masterclass as well. And so I think it's pretty important that we hold on to those because we do a sausage, which we call our 1844s for obvious reasons, as it's when we were established.
Yes, that's
And that
great.
Recipe goes back to my great-great-great-grandfather.
Oh, wonderful.
And so that is something that we do keep. And things we make, things like biltong now, and we do a lot of charcuterie, where we make a lot of salamis and sausage sec and copper and parma ham and that sort of stuff. And we wouldn't tell everybody exactly how to do that either.
Sure, well, I like that.
And we sort of household-wise, we put people in the right direction, but not fully.
Right, of course. Now, I was a long-time vegetarian. I became a vegetarian because the meats were being fed these horrible things, and this is many, like a long time ago. But the cows are so sweet. I mean, how do you go look at them and then knowing they're going to end up in your meat locker? So was that something that just became natural to you because your whole family's been in that business? Or as a youth, was there something that clicked? How did that work that you're comfortable with that?
So firstly, I am the same as you. I'm not a vegetarian, but I would not eat any meat that is not fed for the same reasons. I just don't eat if I don't know where it comes from. So I've been that way for probably 10 years. We're very, very careful, both my wife and I and most of my team here, of what we eat, because we do understand, especially in pork and poultry, of just how much that is, I think, really not good for you. As regards to the animal, you are so right in that I know no different. I was brought up with it. And I've been around both farms and the slaughterhouse right from a very early age, from secondary school of 10 and 11, I used to come and clean here when there was a slaughter process. So I have worked for really all my life with it. So you do get used to it. But there is another side of me that is, if you're going to eat meat, then I think there's a little bit of being willing to kill that meat. I'd have no customers if everybody agreed with that. So I don't have a problem. And actually, I suppose when I get to those pearly gates and somebody says to me, you've killed all these animals in the past, I would definitely be able to say I've always done it to the best of my ability to try to do it as humanely possible, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely.
And so really stand the ground on that. And in our training, it's very much that way. Even a comment from one of my staff that would be derogatory to an animal would be stamped on straight away, never mind an action. And so I think we all feel that way. I think going back to you saying respect, I think that's where it comes from, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
So I don't get that feeling. I do find that, you know, you get a little spring lamb. It's a lovely animal. You know, I am an animal lover. I have a dog, which I adore. You know, I would justify it that it is part of the evolution of what we do, as long as you do it to the best of your ability. I actually don't think it is done. I'm not particularly religious. And I'm not against any religions, and I really respect everybody for their view, but I'm amazed that religious slaughter is still allowed, because I think both kosher and halal is definitely not the way that you should slaughter animals. It is a real problem to any animal when they are put through their systems. And you'd think that we'd move further away from that. But originally, the reason those religions were put through was to do with the bleeding of the animal. And when we look back hundreds of years, the people who said that the animal's throat should be cut and not stunned, they didn't understand what that did to the animals because they didn't have the technology there. Whereas now we're able to put ECG tests on lambs, we're able to put sensors on the heads, and we can actually measure that stress that happens when halal is done. So we know it's wrong, whereas when they came out, we didn't know it was wrong.
Right.
And yet it still goes on. And also the other part is that we can also test that the blood has all gone from that carcass. So we've got much more technology, whereas they didn't have that hundreds of years ago. And so you can justify the reason that they did that, whereas now I don't think they can.
Right. Well, I certainly appreciate that you've taken the time to research and find out about all of the latest and greatest technology and are using it in the very best possible way.
Yeah.
So, Callum, what is your favorite steak?
I often get asked that in when masterclasses, and yeah, I don't really have a favorite. I definitely wouldn't say fillet steak, which is maybe the entrecote or the undercut, or what you call it in the States. It's a very expensive one that's on the inside. That would not be my favorite. It's the most tender, but I would like something that has a bit more consistency to it. I think it's more to do with the animal itself. You get certain cattle that just look amazing, the right amount of fat cover. And I think it's more to do with my favorite animal more than the favorite actual steak, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. So you keep your eye on the cattle that come in.
Yeah, I think the other thing we do with the team, if we have animals from another farm, we will test that as well, and we'll see how it matures and whether we think it is the right thing, that we have gone down the right way. Did that just recently with a new producer. And then actually it wasn't what we were wanting, and so we're actually going to buy from them because we don't think it is quite there. So, yeah, these are things that are really important to me. And I think, really, I'm very much a little bit of something good is better than a lot of something that's not good. I think when it comes to really good quality meat, when you were saying that you were vegetarian, my wife and I always say our diet is vegetable-based, without doubt. We have much more vegetable than anything else, but we have a vegetable-based diet with meat. I know probably the States gets the worst, but, you know, the UK is not far behind through COVID. Obesity has been a big thing. And actually, from our team, I think we've got 12 of us, but, you know, it's amazing how slim everybody is, eating the right type of food,
right.
And
yes,
also being busy.
Sally, first, can you share where your farm is in England?
Yes, it's on a peninsula called the Wirral, which is halfway between Liverpool and the city of Chester, which is an old Roman city. We sit halfway between those two cities on a peninsula, the northwest of England.
Is it a particularly good area to raise turkeys?
Well, it is, in so much as we've got the natural environment, we've got the rural surroundings, but we're still very close to people. who want to buy the product and people who want to come and experience our farming and food. So they don't have to travel very far. So we're not right out in the sticks in the middle of nowhere.
Right. Now, what is it about the climate or landscape that perhaps creates your biggest challenge with raising turkeys?
I haven't really got a challenge as such. How it works, obviously the turkeys are allowed to range. We have them indoors overnight, but they're in big, airy barns, huge barns with lots of air flowing through them, and they're allowed to roam and perch in there. Then they have access to the outside, which is just sort of grassland, so they're not in hills, they're not on extreme land, it's just on green pasture. But what we do is we sometimes try and plant other crops for them, like we've done sunflowers that we grow, and then the turkeys, once they're old enough, are allowed out and they can go through the sunflowers, and, you know, they love that, to sort of scrub around and have a go at any vegetation. But we leave everything quite natural. I mean, there's nettles, there's thistles, there's grass. Anything that grows out in the paddocks, they have access to. And they choose to eat it or not, entirely up to the turkeys. So we don't have land challenges as such. As long as everything's got plenty of space and the land is not allowed to get sort of muddy and out of control like that, then it's fine.
Nice. So regarding the cover crops that they're eating, do you have to reseed very often? You just mentioned you do plant sunflowers. Does the other vegetation take care of itself pretty much?
Yes, it does.
Lovely.
Yeah. So I only plant something if I want to switch it up sometimes, and I will. But no, the vegetation is mostly natural. And then every couple of years, I'll put sunflowers out and just try something a bit different. And it looks beautiful, and it gives them cover as well if they need it.
Yes, I'm sure it looks gorgeous. How much of an area do they forage, and how many are we talking?
The maximum of stocking density is 25 kilos of meat per square meter. Really, that's the guideline to be able to call them free range, which is twice as much as a turkey that's intensively reared. I have probably about an acre, and there's 1,000 birds, and they have access to more if they want it or if I think they need it. It's something you have to manage, because obviously you can't just let them go completely wherever they want to, because you have to obviously be able to bring them in at night. They will get preyed on by the foxes, and obviously there are other thieves around, not just four-legged ones. So we do bring them in at night, and we use the dogs to do that. But they soon learn to come in, so they can go as far as they need to, but we don't let them wander ad lib, because obviously then we lose control of where they are, and they can easily put themselves in danger. So we need to keep them safe, but we need to make them happy.
Yes, yes. Now, tell us about the Wirral turkey, and why raise that breed?
These turkeys are specially developed for slow growing, and they have different colours, different sizes, and they're usually smaller. I use these because the customers that I supply actually want a very, very special turkey. They don't want anything that's been intensively reared, so you have to have something that suits the environment and is able to range. So these birds have been literally selected the way they are for fitness, the way they are for shape, the way they are for flavour and for texture of the meat if grown to the correct age, and really just to get the best experience out of them. We don't, for that reason, use any commercial type turkeys which grow very quickly. All my turkeys are matured naturally and very slowly. So they do actually have a life that's three times longer than perhaps a standard turkey would be.
What would that standard be? How long, for instance?
It could be as little as 10 weeks, up to about 16 weeks. Ours go 24 to 30 weeks.
Mm. That's so great.
It is quite significantly longer.
Yes. And how do you see that enhancing the final product?
By growing things slowly, you can use the cereal diet, so you don't have to use any special proteins or growth promoters. Once you've got this maturity, you can put the layer of fat down that actually helps produce absolutely fantastic flavour and makes the turkey not as dry, because it's something that people have often said that they don't like about turkey, it's too dry. But we feel our turkeys are not like that. They've been grown especially to make them mature, to keep them moist. And then, of course, there's also the way we actually slaughter and prepare them also helps developing the flavour and texture of the meat. So everything is done to actually end up with this really special experience in flavour and texture that is probably not like any other turkey that's produced in a different system.
Yes, I've read, and I believe it was actually on your website, about the gas flushing that is done in commercially produced turkeys. And I'm wondering, could you just share what that is? I know you would never do this.
Well, I can tell you what I do, and then I can tell you why I don't need to use gas flushing.
Please.
I'm not an expert on gas flushing, so I don't really want to say things that I don't.
Sure. Thank you.
But I can certainly tell you that all our birds are individually prepared. Each bird is treated with respect. It's taken right through the system, and it doesn't have water put through it at all. And because of that, because we individually prepare every bird by dry plucking, and we stun the birds on slaughter, so everything's done humanely, and we have guidelines that we have to stick to and are applied at all times. We actually slaughter the birds, we pluck them, and then we hang them. And we hang them with the guts in for up to 2 weeks. And this is to encourage the meat to draw the flavour from the bird. And we are able to do that because we do this, what they call delayed evisceration. Whereas in a commercial plant, they have to slaughter, they have to pluck, and they have to clean out the bird all in the one process. So there's no delayed hanging period. And there's obviously a lot of water and heat involved. And so in order to extend shelf life, which obviously when birds are supplied to big organisations and shops and supermarkets, there has to be a way of trying to extend the shelf life beyond what would be literally 2 or 3, 5 days or something without this flushing of the gas through the bird. So they basically slaughter it, prepare it, and then the bird is put through a flushing system of gas, and the gas is pushed through the bird, and that helps preserve the meat.
Got it.
If you like. I don't understand the chemistry of it. That's how large companies and large organisations are able to produce fresh turkeys at Christmas in so many numbers. In years gone by, turkeys were sold frozen in supermarkets. Until gas flushing became available, it means they can start slaughtering a lot earlier and therefore increase the volume, and they can be stored in this way and sold as fresh for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever it is, instead of 3 or 4 days. In the process that I use, because it's dry and it's traditional and each bird is handled individually, we can do the delayed evisceration. And it means we can keep these birds hanging for up to 2 weeks and extract the flavour and the texture. And then as soon as we do the final dressing at the end, then they go into a chill room, and we can sell them fresh actually at Christmas.
Yes.
So it's a totally different process. It's chalk and cheese.
Yes. Now, if you were in the US, you'd be awfully busy because you'd have Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Yes. Well, my daughter does turkey in the USA, actually,
in the
same way that I do them.
Oh, where does she live?
She's in Wyoming.
Well, I was just thinking, I have a big problem here. How am I going to get a turkey for Thanksgiving? And being in Colorado, that could be possible.
It could, but she lives in Cody, Wyoming.
All right. Well, I'm going to look into that. Now, Sally, does she have the same royal turkeys or other kinds?
No, she doesn't have world turkeys. She has slow-growing turkeys of different colours, bronze, black and white, and they are the same breeding types as the ones that we use here in the UK.
Wonderful. Sally, tell us about your more gamey birds. What makes that so, and how would you describe the actual taste of something that's more gamey than, I believe, the white world?
Right. Well, it's very hard to explain how it tastes, but there is definitely a different texture. Do you have game birds like partridge and pheasant? And
yes.
I don't know whether you hang birds like that. It just brings out a much stronger flavour, and the texture of the meat changes.
Do you prefer that?
Well, yes, we do, and lots of people do. And lots of customers that I've had over the years, that once they've tried a bronze or a black turkey, which after hanging actually produce an even stronger flavour than the white ones, because I grow all my turkeys in the same way, because they have the same rearing experience and the same nutrition, and the same handling once they're dispatched. The meat develops in a slightly different way. I don't know, in America you have the Narragansett and those heritage breeds. These turkeys' ancestors were those sorts of birds, but they've been brought into the modern day but retained texture and flavour. And I actually have a lot of people who, once they've tried these bronze and black ones, say that they would never go back to a white turkey because they enjoy that extra flavour, the extra experience. Because one of the things that people say about turkey is, oh, it has no flavour, it's dry, it's this, it's that. But that is because I think they've probably not been eating the real thing.
Yes, yes.
And once you've had a properly prepared turkey and it's been hung and it's been cooked properly, it has flavour, it is moist, and it's a fantastic experience. And it's a very good product for feeding a lot of people. These types of turkeys carry a lot of breast meat. A 6 kilo, 13-pound turkey can feed easily 10 to 12 people and have leftovers for different things. So you get a very good value product, exceptionally good standard of meat.
Absolutely, yes. And it's wonderful to see that more and more it's becoming available. Now, Sally, do you have any advice for someone going into turkey production, whether it's to have a couple of turkeys or 500? And of course, you could write a course on it, but I'm just looking for one key thing.
I would say you have to choose the correct breed, slaughter them in the correct way, and handle them correctly after they've been dispatched, because it's all about the hanging and the preparation at that slaughter end that really makes a difference. So you've got to have a product that is suitable, and you've got to be able to handle that bird correctly and get the best out of it.
Yes, admittedly, Callum is the first butcher I've ever spoken with in depth, and it's quite an art, isn't it, just in the hanging process? I'm sure there's a feel and a scent and a moisture that you get to know when something is ready to move to the next step.
Yes. I think you've got to have a good level of stockmanship. You've got to rear a good, healthy, happy animal. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it be a turkey or a steer or whatever. If you can give that animal a stress-free life, when you come to slaughter it and you have as least stress in that situation as well, it all follows through and you can end up with something that's rather special. And I like to think that when people walk out of the farm here feeling that they've just bought something really, really special, it's been produced and hand done for them, that is what gives you pleasure, is knowing that you've provided someone with a pleasurable experience.
Now, it's not just a holiday season for you, or is it? Do you only sell turkeys at the holiday time?
I do only do these turkeys for Christmas because it's so labor-intensive.
All right, yes.
And it's not something that you could gear up easily to do all through the year. And also, because all these birds are done individually, you know, there is a cost to that. So these birds are produced only really for Christmas because
all
it's
right.
the one time of year that people are happy to buy something very special. And we can't get the same sorts of returns throughout the year. And in England, Christmas is the turkey dinner.
Right. Do you have a turkey cooking secret you could share with us?
Oh, well, the person to speak to about that is Callum Edge's wife, Debbie. No, I tell you what we do here, and it has worked, is we supply every turkey with the little pop-up meat thermometers. And the reason that we started doing that about 6 years ago is because there are so many different ways and timings of cooking turkey. A lot of people would overcook turkey or
right.
overcook poultry. So in the end, we looked at these little meat thermometer devices. We tested them and found them to work.
Perfect.
Purely because some people will brine their turkeys, some people will barbecue their turkeys, some people will fry them, some people roast them. It was virtually impossible to give an individual recipe and timings. By using this, they just insert it in the bird, and when that little meat timer pops up, it's not overcooked, it's a thermometer, so it's telling them that the turkey is done correctly. They are very good,
yeah.
but you have to trust them. A lot of people say, oh, I'll just give it an extra 10 minutes just to make sure. Well, don't, because when that little arrow pops up, the meat is perfectly cooked and you can just take it out and let the meat rest.
And then just one more question for you. What is your favorite accompaniment to a holiday turkey dinner?
Oh, my favorite accompaniment would be some homemade stuffing, actually.
All right. And what does your homemade stuffing have in it?
Oh, it has the Gloucester Old Spot pork meat. It has herbs. It has some dried fruits and all sorts of things. I actually cheat and I use one that Callum Edge's wife produces.
All right.
Produces.
I'd hardly call that cheating. I'd call that just being wise.
I would call it being savvy, no.
Exactly, yes.
I just like a good old-fashioned oven-roasted turkey with some beautiful homemade stuffing, with the crispy skin on the turkey, and fantastic experience.
I just love the love and care everyone is taking with their animals. Many thanks to Rosie Ball, Callum Edge, and Sally Lee. They're all making me homesick for my mom's homeland. So that being the case, I dedicate this show to my aunt and uncle, Jean and Nigel Kemp, and my two cousins I'm still in touch with, Graham and Ian. This is Cultivated Audio at cultivatedaudio.com. Okay, here we are. Thanks all for making Here Where We Want to Be. This is Robin Clare.